your artifacts. If you want to catch lobster, you can stay on the goddamn jetty. Kohler smiled and asked if he could dive with the gang again. The thugs did not like outsiders, but they liked Kohler. The kid had matched them drink for drink, and he hated the same charter captains they did. Best of all, he seemed at one with their pirate sensibilities. They made him a proposition. "You're the beer meister," they said. "You bring the beer, and you can come along on our next charter." Kohler brought waterfalls of beer, and he continued bringing it for a year. He'd never known men who partied so hard. The gang raised hell in pizza joints before dives, mooned passing family vessels, wore plastic pig noses and snorted at enemy boat captains, all the while consuming booze and food in quantities that would shame a frat house. In between the fun, the gang threw an education into Kohler, the likes of which a diver could not purchase for any price. Like army sergeants, the men stripped Kohler of his civilian equipment and began to outfit him in the gear of the great wreck diver. His harness? It sucked. Buy this kind. His lights? Trash the Florida shit and buy brighter. This is the Atlantic, for Christ's sake. His $50 knife? Too goddamn fancy. Use a cheapo you won't chase and drown for if you drop it. The lessons were clear. If a diver was going to go places no other men dared, he had better have the hardware to do it. Then the men set about to strip him of old thinking. They pushed him to study deck plans and photographs in order to determine a wreck's meatiest locations. Divers who barreled in and dug blindly for prizes never bagged up like a man with knowledge. They preached a group ethos whereby the gang worked together and shared the spoils. Kohler should always expect to bag another guy's stuff or finish another's hard labor or do whatever else it took to maximize the haul. And Kohler's cutthroat attitude toward artifacts? Beautiful, baby, but not inside the group. Inside the group, remember this. We never fuck each other. The thugs did their best teaching on the way to the wrecks, and their method was ancient and indelible. They discussed how a wreck's tilt betrayed where its artifacts lay. They revealed the beauty of using brains and a steel wedge over brawn and a sledgehammer. They were living encyclopedias of dive accidents. They studied the sport's close calls, bends hits, and drownings, deconstructing each incident until they understood its genesis and could intuit its prevention. After years of absorbing how other men had fucked up and died, they believed, a diver was that much less likely to do it himself. The divers battered Kohler with talk of survival. They taught him that so long as he was breathing, he was okay. They taught him to answer a rising panic by slowing down, falling back, and talking himself through the situation. They branded into him the horror of shooting to the surface without decompressing. And when they said, "I'd rather slit my throat than take that kind of Ben's hit," he believed them because they had seen men climb aboard a boat with their blood foaming and their hearts choking. They warned him, relentlessly, about the snowball effect, the process whereby a diver ignores a minor problem or two, only to encounter other problems that combine with the earlier ones to doom him. "Always answer the first problem immediately and fully," they said, "or you're fucking dead." Kohler took in every word. When they brought him to the most dangerous wrecks, he held his own, bagged up, and stayed safe. Over the next year, he signed up for every charter the gang booked. To these men, Kohler was the Young Turk, but he brought a package to the table unlike any they had seen. The kid knew no skepticism or cynicism. No goal was impossible to Kohler, no idea too grand. He believed, for Christ's sake, that the gang could take the bell off the bow of the Coimbra, even though that wreck was 400 feet long and in 180 feet of freezing water, and no diver had ever been to the bow before. "That's a great way to get us killed, smartass," they told him, pelting him with beer cans. Yet, as much as the men laughed at the scope of Kohler's vision, As much as they broke his balls and delighted in the shades of red he turned, while insisting, "It's possible," they found themselves challenged to ask why Kohler might not be right. A month after Kohler proposed the hunt for the Coimbra's Bell, the gang armed itself with extra tanks, devised a teamwork-driven battle plan, and became the first divers ever to explore that shipwreck's bow. To this day, no one has recovered the Bell from the wreck. One day, on the way back from a dive, the divers' discussion turned to solidarity. If the gang could add members and organize themselves, they could charter their own boats, thereby saving money and dictating destinations. It would require a commitment. A member would pay for charters whether he attended or not. But in that way, the group could build real power. One by one, the men on the trip said, "I'm in." The gang would need an official name. Someone suggested Atlantic Wreck Divers. Perfect. Someone else recommended Matching Windbreakers. "We're not a goddamn bowling team," was the collective reply. "How about matching denim jackets with skull and crossbones patches?" That was more like it. Now the six original members had to elect an additional four, and the vote had to be unanimous. Only the very best divers were nominated, matching souls who had dived with the gang and shared their mindset. When Kohler's name was offered, four thumbs went up and two went sideways. His heart sank. No one said a word. When the two members with sideways thumbs were convinced they had sufficiently traumatized Kohler, they turned their thumbs to the sky. "Ball breakers to the end," Kohler thought. Beer flowed. Oaths of loyalty were sworn. The Atlantic Wreck Divers had been born. Around the time Kohler became an Atlantic Wreck Diver, he heard through the grapevine that his father was dating his ex-girlfriend, a woman Richie had lived with the year before. He confronted his father, who admitted it was true, and that the relationship had been going on for months. Richie was devastated. For a minute he could not speak. "How could you?" he finally choked out. "I'm your father and I can do what I want," the elder Kohler said. "If you don't like it, there's the door." The door. If Richie walked through it, there would be no coming back. In his father's world, a person who took the door could never come back. Richie's throat lumped and his forehead flushed. His breath howled as it rushed through his nostrils. He could back down now. He could mutter some face-saving obscenity and save his job and his future and his relationship with his father. And besides, he did not love the girl anymore. And who the hell was she to push him through the door? He looked into his father's eyes. The man did not blink. If Richie walked now, he would lose this man, this strong man who knew the ocean and understood business and had toughened him to the world. Could he do it? Kohler knew his life. He could stick with anything if he knew it was right. "I'll take the door," he told his father. That day, Richie removed his possessions from the basement at Fox Glass. It would be years before he would see his father again. Now Richie had to find work. A glass salesman tipped him to a company paying top dollar and looking for someone with his experience. A few days later, he was working as a mechanic for Act II Glass and Mirrors, a business that served New York's Orthodox Jewish community. He hit it off with the owner, and 4 months later, he was the company's foreman. Over the next 2 years, Kohler worked hard and provided a vision for the company. The owner rewarded the effort by making Kohler a partner. Life was good again. During summers, he committed to the Atlantic Wreck Divers. The ocean had never seen anything quite like that gang before. Food was religion on AWD charters. Members brought along the finest cold cuts, cheeses, pepperonis, and pastries. And they did so in quantities worthy of Roman orgies. If one man brought his wife's special tomato and mozzarella salad, another man would outdo him the next week with his wife's slow-cooked pork tenderloin. The divers might even barbecue steaks, chicken, and the occasional speared flounder on the back of the boat. Rascality was prized even above gluttony. Often, without warning the boat captain, the gang would yell, "Swim break!" and get naked and jump into the ocean, never letting go of their beer cans as they bobbed in the water. Members brought along guns and slung stuffed animals into the air for target practice. When a black tie party boat passed, the gang would throw beer cans at the vessel and break into their trademark ditty. "Cat's ass, rat's ass, dirty old twat, 69 douchebags tied in a knot, cocksucker, motherfucker, dicky licker too, I'm a fucking scuba diver, who the fuck are you?" If the passing partygoer seemed insufficiently offended, the gang would seal the deal by mooning the boat. Every AWD member was known by a nickname. Pete Guglieri, the oldest and most level-headed member, was Emperor. Jeff Pagano was Hate Man for his negative outlook. Pat Rooney was Hammer for the tool he carried underwater. John Lackenmeyer, Swinging Jack, for his tendency to walk around naked, while Brad Sheard, the aerospace engineer, went by Dick Whittler, because of the piece of driftwood he'd tried to whittle into a sailboat that had turned out looking more phallic than maritime. Kohler had earned his moniker during a discussion about Richard Pryor's freebasing accident. Because his work took him into the most drug-infested sections of Brooklyn, he'd been able to explain to the gang the difference between cocaine and crack. After that, he was crackhead. Around this time, Kohler met Felicia Becker, a dark and pretty sales clerk for one of Kohler's glass business customers. She understood his passion for diving. They married in the fall of 1989, and shortly after the wedding, Felicia became pregnant. One night that year, Kohler stopped for dinner at a Spanish restaurant in Brooklyn. He was alone. As he sat at the bar, he felt a slap on his back. It was his father. The two had neither seen nor spoken to each other in 5 years. The elder Kohler asked if he could sit down. Richie told him he could. "You're going to be a grandfather," Richie said. His father did not even know his son had married. Richie and his father spent hours catching up on their lives and families. Neither man mentioned Richie's old girlfriend. His father asked him to come back to Fox Glass. Richie told him he could not work for anyone after having been a partner in his own business. His father proposed that they become partners and open their own glass company in New Jersey. And Richie accepted. He had stuck to his resolve. It was his father who had moved. He was happy to be back in the family business. He was happier to know that if he committed to something, even something so wrenching as leaving his father, he could see that decision through. In 1990, Kohler and Felicia celebrated the arrival of their first child, a son. Kohler worked grueling hours, then devoted his free time to Atlantic wreck divers. Their handmade, photocopied schedules were collector's items in the dive community. The single-page calendar was strewn with pornographic images taken from cheap men's magazines. Phone numbers such as 1-800-EAT-SHIT were listed as contacts. One schedule promised beer-tasting sessions, pig-calling lessons, lesbian watching, automatic weapons, more beer-tasting sessions, greenhorn bashing, as well as some great fucking diving. Another said, "If you don't have our numbers, we don't want you fucking diving with us." In the center was a list of dates, boats, and wreck destinations. Often the vessel the gang had chartered was the Wahoo, Steve Belenda's boat. For a while, Kohler had no problem using the Wahoo. But recently, Kohler had clashed with Belenda, one time nearly coming to blows. Now Kohler needed a new boat to get to the Doria. He had dived several times with Nagel on the Seeker, to the Dirly Chine, the Bight of End, and the Resor, and had long admired Nagel's legend. And while Nagel had a reputation for crudeness and impatience, he had always treated Kohler with respect. Kohler signed up for several Seeker charters in 1990 and 1991. Though Chatterton was practically running Nagel's business by then, he and Kohler never found themselves together aboard the boat. In the fall of 1991, Kohler heard word of the Virgin U-boat discovery. The news stopped his life. For days he was a blur of longing and desire, pacing the floors at home and at work, distracted from family and friends, unable to sort out the details of his yearning. Then Brennan called and said, "You're in." And the words lifted Kohler back to the days when his father told stories of Mr. Siegel, and he became proud of his last name and the way Germans built machines. And it carried him across the thousands of pages he had read about World War II and the courage of men and steel nets stretched across New York. And it ferried him over the sailboat he and his pal Don had designed to circle the world. Above the Navy man who had promised a submarine, beyond the gear he had used to penetrate alien worlds. And he knew that he had to be part of this Virgin U-boat, because for 29 years it had been part of him. Chapter 7 Horenberg's Knife. The swastikas on the dishes Chatterton recovered from the U-boat reached through time and chokeholded his imagination. A person could spend a lifetime studying Nazis and U-boats, and in the end it was all just information. The dishes were heavy. The swastika's angled arms rubbed rough against a person's fingertips. Even with closed eyes one could detect the infamous shape. No one had catalogued or curated or even touched this china since the U-boat fell. The dishes had traveled from Hitler's Third Reich directly to Chatterton's living room, and for that unbroken path they still seemed treacherous on his mantle. If there were a few in the diving community who still had not heard of the mystery wreck after Feldman's death, that changed with the discovery of the dishes. Now it seemed that every conversation in every dive shop along the eastern seaboard involved the U-boat and its possible identity. Chatterton and Nagel were certain that such attention would grind against Belinda's ego. The king of the deep could not abide pretenders to his throne, and while he likely did not yet know the sub's location, they believed it would be only a matter of time before he wrested it from his Coast Guard connections and set sail to raid their wreck. Ordinarily the Seeker would have been back to the submarine the next week. The men were sure that with another dive or two the U-boat would surrender her name. But it was now hurricane season, the time of year when windows of opportunity were measured in hours rather than months. Landlocked, Nagel renewed his vow to get sober and work his body back into diving shape for next season. Chatterton returned to his research. If he could not penetrate the wreck from the ocean, he would try to get inside it through history. While a few of the divers had thumbed library books looking for insight into the wreck, Chatterton continued to research as he had from the beginning, by submitting written requests to an archivist at the Naval Historical Center in Washington, D.C. The NHC was the Fort Knox of naval war records, and it was from the archivist's expertise that Chatterton hoped to mine hidden nuggets. But replies took weeks, and when they did arrive, they consisted of one-page general information synopses. If Chatterton was going to penetrate beneath history's crust, he would have to make the research more personal and immediate. Chatterton was not the only man engaged in serious investigation. From his home in New Providence, New Jersey, Kohler barrel-rolled into his collection of U-boat books, devouring titles past midnight, even when his glass company demanded that he be fresh before dawn. Mornings, he used one eye to shave and the other to choose additional titles from his Naval Institute press catalog, then wrote checks to the company for sums he hoped his wife would never notice. He introduced himself at a German-American club on Route 130 in Burlington, New Jersey, where he told the elderly membership the story of the mystery U-boat and recruited volunteers to help him translate the German books he had purchased. One day he called a dive charter captain who had once mentioned knowing a U-boat crewman. He asked the captain to seek out this U-boat man and see if he had any suggestions that might help identify the wreck. The captain spoke to the veteran and then called Kohler. "Search the boots," the captain said.
"Huh?"
"Search the boots. If you can find boots on the wreck, look inside them. The guy says they all wrote their names inside their boots so no one else would wear them. They hated when other guys wore their boots. And they put their watches and jewelry in their boots, too. And some of that stuff also had their names." Kohler resolved to search the boots. None of the other divers would think to look inside a rotting old boot. They would likely swim past footwear in search of more dishes or a builder's plaque or some other glamorous artifact. If he could, Kohler would search every boot he saw. Then Kohler hit upon another idea, this one maybe his best. He had heard that a retired U-boat commander, Herbert Werner, lived in America. But Werner was not just any commander. He had written Iron Coffins, a memoir that had become a classic in the genre. Kohler poked around library white pages until he hit gold. Werner not only lived in America, he lived in ever-loving New Jersey. Kohler got his number and, trembling, dialed one of the great U-boat commanders. A man answered in a light German accent.
"Hello, I'm looking for Mr. Herbert Werner," Kohler said.
"This is Herbert Werner."
Kohler's heart raced.
He might have the answer to the U-boat mystery before he hung up the phone.
"Sir, my name is Richard Kohler. I'm a diver. My colleagues and I found a U-boat off the New Jersey coast. Sir, the reason I'm calling..."
"Everything I have to say I said in my book," Werner stated in an even and measured tone. "I have nothing more to say."
"But if I can just ask..."
"Goodbye," Werner said pleasantly, then hung up. Kohler held the receiver to his ear for a minute before he could bring himself to replace it. Weeks had passed since the dishes came out of the wreck. The divers had put in dozens of hours of research, and one fact screamed above all the rest. No U-boat had ever been recorded sunk within 100 miles of the wreck site. To Chatterton, it seemed as if his research with the archivist at the Naval Historical Center was moving backward. And he and Nagel could virtually hear Belinda warming up the Wahoo's engines. Chatterton hit upon an idea. Why not put out news of the U-boat discovery to the world? Surely there were historians or experts or governments who knew the wreck's identity. Why not expedite the research by going to those who know? The seeker would still enjoy the glory and fame of discovery. Belinda and others would be precluded from claim-jumping the wreck, and the mystery would be solved through the seeker's research. There was risk in the idea, namely that someone else would get credit for making the identification. Chatterton decided he could handle that scenario. He pitched Nagel on writing a press release. Nagel loved the idea.
"Put my name and phone number at the bottom," he told Chatterton.
At the local library, Chatterton found a book on how to write press releases. At home that night, he came up with this. "For immediate release, October 10th, 1991. Divers discover mystery U-boat off New Jersey coast. Captain Bill Nagel and the divers from the Brielle, New Jersey charter vessel Seeker have located a World War II German U-boat sunk only 65 miles from the New Jersey coast, at approximate latitude 40, longitude 73-30. The wreck lies upright and is essentially intact, though it shows damage from an apparent depth charge attack. The U-boat is in 230 feet of water, making it accessible to only a select few experienced deep-wreck divers. The submarine was located on Labor Day, during a Seeker expedition to identify undiscovered wrecks. On a subsequent trip to the wreck, Seeker crew member John Chatterton recovered two china dishes from deep within the wreck, each emblazoned with the Nazi swastika and dated 1942, proof of the sub's origin. The items recovered from the wreck prove it is a World War II German U-boat. But which one? No German submarines were ever reported sunk within 150 miles of this location, and German records contain no accounts of U-boats being lost in New Jersey waters. Divers from the Seeker will continue to cautiously probe the wreck to discover its identity and unravel the mystery of why it is where it is. A small piece of naval history may have to be rewritten. Contact Captain Bill Nagel. Kevin Brennan gave Chatterton a black-and-white photo of one of the dishes to include with the release. Chatterton made a list of all the media outlets he knew, a total of 10 names, including local newspapers, the Associated Press, UPI, and diving magazines. He mailed a press release and photo to each address. A day passed without a reply. Then a few days. Chatterton checked Nagel's phone several times. He called the phone company and asked that they check Nagel's line. The phone was working fine. Finally, Chatterton called Nagel. "Well, that didn't work," he said. "Looks like it," Nagel grumbled. Several days later, Nagel's phone rang. He referred the call to Chatterton. It was from a reporter at the Newark Star-Ledger, an important New Jersey daily newspaper. The man sounded weary and uninterested. His questions dripped with skepticism, as if he were being forced to interview yet another Billy Bob who had discovered a spaceship in his backyard. "So you supposedly found some mysterious U-boat, huh?" the reporter asked. Chatterton said that he had. The man asked more questions. To each, Chatterton provided a detailed answer. By the end of the conversation, the reporter asked if he might visit Chatterton's home. A day later, he was there taking notes and handling the china. He said he thought the story might be good enough to run on page one. The next morning, Chatterton walked in bathrobe and slippers to the end of his driveway and picked up the Star-Ledger. At the bottom was a headline: U-boat wreck found off Point Pleasant. Alongside the story was a photo of Nagel and Chatterton inspecting the dishes. Chatterton ran inside and called Nagel. The story summed it all up: the dangers of deep-wreck diving, the ominous presence of U-boats in American waters, Feldman's death, the ongoing mystery of the sub's identity. It also quoted Professor Henry Keats, an author and U-boat expert. "They have definitely found a German U-boat," Keats told the paper. "The mystery is how it ended up where it is today. None is supposed to be in this area." The Star-Ledger story unleashed a media frenzy. That evening, Nagel's and Chatterton's phones rang nonstop with interview requests from radio, television, and print reporters. International media ran the story of the mystery U-boat discovered off the New Jersey coast. CNN sent a crew. Television reporters had Nagel and Chatterton hold the dishes up, swastika side out, while they interviewed the pair aboard the Seeker. Even the tabloid Weekly World News ran a front-page item: "Nazi sub captured by U.S. Navy ship." The story, fantastical even by that publication's standards, told not only of the New Jersey U-boat, but of a second U-boat, one that had sailed from Germany into a time warp and had only surfaced today, its still youthful crewmen convinced that Hitler ruled Germany. It quoted a Washington-based Navy officer, who said, "I don't know all that much about time warps,
but that seems to be the only explanation for this whole situation. Chatterton's phone, which had sat silent for 2 weeks after the press release, now rang so relentlessly it threatened his sleep and his meals. His mailbox overflowed. Packages were delivered to him addressed simply, John Chatterton, Diver, New Jersey. Many of the contacts came from people who claimed to know the identity of the U-boat or the explanation for its sinking. Sons, mothers, brothers, and grandchildren swore that loved ones had attacked and sunk a U-boat on a secret mission that the government still refused to acknowledge. Others called, claiming to have classified U-boat information. Still others told of seeing U-boat crewmen swimming onto American shores to buy bread or attend dances. One elderly caller told of meeting an old German man while fishing as a teenager. The guy looked at the spot on our chart we'd been fishing and said that's where he'd lost his U-boat, the man told Chatterton. It was at the same spot you found your wreck. Several widows called, saying that their husbands had sunk U-boats, but had never received credit. A scholarly-sounding man called and said that the mystery could be solved simply by wiping the dirt from the conning tower, as U-boats had their numbers painted prominently on the side. One man called and spoke in a heavy German accent.
"I am looking for the diver who found the U-boat," the man said.
"Okay, that's me," Chatterton said.
"What can you tell me about the diver who died?"
"Well, he was a pretty good diver. It was a terrible accident."
"His name was Feldman?"
"Yeah."
"How do you spell that?"
F-E-L-D-M-A-N.
"Was Feldman a Jew?"
Chatterton hung up after that. On another day, he received a call from a different man with a thick German accent.
"Your bubbles are disturbing the sailor's slumber,"
the man said before hanging up abruptly. Chatterton researched many of the stories he heard, even the ones that seemed loopy. Stories of U-boat men mixing into the American population turned out to be the product of terrified imaginations. On only a few occasions did men move from U-boats to American soil, and in those cases the men were saboteurs and spies. U-boat conning towers did sport the U-boat's number, as is evidenced in photographs, but only before World War II began. After that, any such markings were erased or painted over. So far, none of Chatterton's leads had inched him any closer to knowing the mystery submarine. Kohler, too, was receiving phone calls. His name had been mentioned in some of the newspaper stories, and, like Chatterton, he heard from family members seeking credit for a supposed U-boat kill a relative had made 50 years ago. He also began to hear from collectors. "Are there human remains on the boat?" one man asked. "We don't know that yet," Kohler said. "I'd like to buy a Nazi skull." "I don't do that." "I'll give you $2,000 for a skull." "I told you I don't do that." "What the hell do you mean you don't do that? We won! Are you some kind of Nazi lover?" So-called collectors, Kohler found, got angry fast. He learned to hang up on them even faster. Not every contact with Chatterton came from family or fanatics or conspiracists. Early on, he received a letter from the German embassy in Washington, D.C. It was written by Dieter Leonhard, a captain in the German Navy. The letter began cordially, acknowledging Chatterton's discovery and offering assistance in researching the wreck. Farther down the page, however, Leonhard made plain Germany's position. "The Federal Republic of Germany retains ownership of the submarines, regardless of whether the present position of the wreck is within national territorial waters or not. Sunken German warships are principally defined to be tombs of a seaman's grave. Diving and exploring the wreck is therefore not permitted without government approval. which has been denied in each case to date. To keep a wreck a tomb, the FRG prohibits any violation to a World War II sub and will enforce this condition through legal means. Chatterton called the phone number on the stationery and was transferred to Leonard. Chatterton told him that he had received the letter and would be grateful for assistance with documents and research. Leonard said he would be happy to help. Chatterton then popped his big question. "Do you know the identity of the wreck?" Leonard said that the German government often relied on a man named Horst Bredow at the U-boat archive in Cuxhaven-Altenbruck as a repository for such information. He offered Chatterton the contact information.
Then Leonard reiterated what he had written in the letter, that Germany did not permit diving on sunken U-boats. "Which U-boat is it?" Chatterton asked. "The one you found," Leonard replied. "Yes, but what is the specific U-boat designation?" "I do not know." "What about the exact location?" Chatterton asked. "I do not know that either." "I'm going to be honest with you," Chatterton said. "I want to be respectful. You don't know what wreck this is, and therefore you can't lay claim to it. My goal is to identify the wreck, to put a name on the tombstone. I'm going to continue diving it until that happens." "You understand our position, Mr. Chatterton. We do not want divers descending on this U-boat and scattering any human remains that might be on board and desecrating the wreck," Leonard said. "We cannot and will not allow that." "I understand that, and I don't intend to allow that to happen," Chatterton said. "It's my first priority to be considerate and respectful. You have my word on that." By now Chatterton understood Leonard's position. The man could not formally grant a diver permission to explore a war grave. He sensed, however, that Leonard, who had kept an even and pleasant tone throughout the conversation, would not make official trouble for him so long as he treated the wreck with respect. The men thanked each other for their time and ended the call. About a week after the first U-boat story appeared, Chatterton began to compile several promising leads. One of the first came from Harry Cooper, the founder and president of Shark Hunters International, a thousands-strong group based in Florida and dedicated to preserving the history of the U-boat Waffe, as their motto read. Chatterton had seen the group's text-crammed, exclamation-point-filled newsletters, homemade-looking publications that mixed interviews, intrigue, history, editorials, criticism, and even the occasional classified ad. Despite the wild look of its mailings, Shark Hunters counted American historians, former U-boat commanders and crewmen, professors, U.S. naval veterans, and other experts among its members. Cooper urged Chatterton to join Shark Hunters, saying that the group had deep and far-reaching contacts he believed could help solve the mystery. Cooper asked questions no one yet had.
"Does your wreck have saddle tanks? Does your wreck have two stern torpedo tubes, or only one?"
The answers could easily be gleaned while diving, Cooper explained, and would reveal much about the U-boat's type and the year it might have sailed. Chatterton resolved to inspect the wreck for that information on the next dive and report back to Cooper with the answers. One morning, a man phoned Chatterton claiming to have sunk a U-boat from a blimp in 1942. A month earlier, such a claim would have sounded like another bit of lunacy to Chatterton. But in his research, Chatterton had learned that blimps had been a formidable force in keeping U-boats submerged and in escorting ships along the eastern seaboard. That at one point during World War II, more than 1,500 pilots had manned blimps considerably larger than the current versions used for advertising. That the blimps carried sophisticated anti-submarine technology. And that a blimp had even fought it out with a surfaced U-boat. A battle that had resulted in injury to the U-boat and the blimp plummeting from the sky. So Chatterton listened.
I'm an old man, and my mind ain't so good, the man said. I don't remember all the details, but I know I sunk a U-boat from a blimp.
Go ahead, sir. I'm listening. I really appreciate the phone call.
Well, I was based out of Lakehurst, New Jersey. I attacked the U-boat close to there. I sunk it with a depth charge. I'm sorry, but that's all I remember. I hope that helps.
Chatterton recorded the man's story on his legal pad and made a note to research any reports his contact at the Naval Historical Center might find for him about blimp attacks on U-boats in the area of the wreck. Another morning, Chatterton drove to the Naval Weapons Station Earl in Monmouth County, New Jersey, and showed a videotape of the wreck to experts in weapons, ordnance, and demolition. They watched the tape again and again. They talked among themselves and used technical words and physics terms in their discussions. They arrived at this consensus. The damage to the U-boat's control room looked to be caused by explosion rather than by collision. The shape and direction of the damaged metal indicated that the explosion likely occurred from outside the submarine, and the damage was likely caused by a force far greater than a depth charge, the weapon used so often by Allied forces against U-boats. Chatterton took notes on everything. He asked the men if they might be kind enough to fashion a guess as to what had caused such cataclysmic damage.
"We can't be certain," one of the men said. "But if we had to guess, we would guess it was damaged by a direct torpedo hit."
A direct torpedo hit? Driving home, Chatterton turned the idea over in his mind 100 times. Who would have fired such a torpedo? An account of an American submarine that had sunk a U-boat would have made every history book. Yet there had been no such incident anywhere close to the wreck site. Could another U-boat have mistakenly sunk a friend? It had happened before, but mostly among U-boat wolf packs, groups of U-boats that hunted enemy ships together. And there was simply no record of a wolf pack anywhere near the wreck site. One thing was certain. The idea that a U-boat had limped from some other location with such an injury, as Nagel and some divers left room to believe, seemed impossible. To Chatterton, whatever had blown up that U-boat had done it at just the place in the ocean where the divers had found it. The Star-Ledger story was barely a week old, and already Chatterton had gathered reams of information from sources great and small. The best, however, were still to come. One arrived in the form of a meeting at Nagel's house, attended by Nagel, Chatterton, and Major Gregory Weidenfeld, a Civil Air Patrol historian who had contacted Nagel through a newspaper reporter. Chatterton had heard of the CAP. They were a group of civilian pilots organized in 1941 by New York's Mayor Fiorello LaGuardia and others to fly small, privately owned airplanes to help defend coastal shipping. On any given night, a deli counterman or an accountant or a dentist might patrol the skies along the New York and New Jersey coasts, hunting U-boats with a pair of mini-bombs jury-rigged under the plane's wings. So patchwork was the weapon system that pilots were sometimes told not to land with the bombs still attached, as the explosives might trigger from the jolt. Instead, they were often advised to drop the bombs whether or not they had spotted a U-boat. Weidenfeld explained that over the course of the war, the CAP had detected more than 150 subs and had dropped depth charges on several of them.
"We sank 2 U-boats, Weidenfeld said, "but we never got credit for either of them."
"I've read about those incidents," Chatterton said. "You guys believe the Navy didn't want to credit civilians."
"That's right," Weidenfeld said. "The Navy didn't want to acknowledge it because it would have terrified the public to think that average civilians were needed to fight the U-boats, and that the U-boats were coming so close to our shores. Anyway, one of the kills was off the Florida coast. The other was in New Jersey."
Chatterton got out his pen. Weidenfeld told the story. On July 11, 1942, two of our pilots and a Grumman Widgeon spotted a U-boat about 40 miles off the coast, just north of Atlantic City. The guys chased the U-boat for 4 hours until it began to rise to periscope depth. When it finally surfaced, they dropped a 325-pound depth charge, and the bomb exploded. They could see an oil slick streaking on the surface where the sub had been. They dropped the other depth charge right into the oil slick. It was a kill, absolutely. The pilots are both dead now. But I've been working for years to get my guys credit for this. I think you found their U-boat. Chatterton was enthralled by the account. Weidenfeld had provided an exact date and a location only about 25 miles from the wreck site. If Chatterton could find a list of U-boats lost in American waters in July 1942, even if the boat was recorded sunk some distance away, he might find a way to explain its movement to the wreck site and solve the mystery. He thanked Weidenfeld and promised to do all he could to resolve the question of whether the lost sub was the one the Civil Air Patrol had killed nearly 50 years ago. A day later, Professor Keats said of the story to the New York Post, "This is the most reasonable account I've heard so far. It could very easily be the same U-boat." At around the same time, another unusual phone call came in, this one from a collector of Nazi memorabilia. This hobbyist, however, made no offer to buy artifacts. "Among other things, I collect photos of U-boat commanders," the man told Chatterton. "I correspond with a lot of these guys. One of them is Carl Friedrich Merton, the 8th most successful U-boat ace of World War II. He read your story in a German newspaper with great interest and has some information he would like to share with you by mail if you'd be kind enough to provide your address." "Absolutely," Chatterton replied. Over the next several weeks, letters arrived from Germany. In them, Merton thanked Chatterton and the divers for their efforts. He also told a singular tale. His colleague, Hannes Weingartner, had also been a U-boat commander, and, like Merton, had been promoted to training flotilla commander, a prestigious land-based position. Weingartner, however, still had battle in his blood, and in 1944, at the advanced age of 35, walked away from the desk and back down through the hatch of a U-boat. His assignment? To take U-851, a type 9D2, or U-cruiser, U-boat, designed for the longest-range patrols, to the Indian Ocean, to carry supplies to Far East German bases, and deliver cargo to the Japanese Navy. The assignment, Merton speculated, might not have been what Weingartner had in mind. He believed Weingartner to have been a submariner of the first hour, meaning that the man's early war roots and instincts to aggressively hunt and kill enemy ships had never withered. I had the impression that Weingartner considered the position of the U-boat war not very different from his last command of September 39, Merton wrote. I don't know the text of his patrol order, but U-851 was certainly not destined for the Indian Ocean, but for the U.S. coast. To Merton, it seemed reasonable that the tameness of Weingartner's assignment might have coaxed his colleague toward New York. "I myself am pretty sure that the wreck you have found will be that of U-851, Merton wrote. The words, "I myself," danced off the airmail stationery and into Chatterton's imagination. In Merton's letter, he now possessed genuine inside information delivered direct by a U-boat ace, a theory that bypassed textbooks and historians and got right to the heart of the matter. Merton knew his friend, and now Chatterton knew Merton. And for this, Chatterton could not remember a time when he felt more excited. As with all the information Chatterton had gathered, he told Kohler nothing of his contact with Merton. Though he had admired Kohler's enthusiasm aboard the boat, he still viewed him as just another guy along for the dive, a man whose artifact lust likely precluded any appetite for history or artistry. Instead, he shared his findings with Yerga, who continued to study the hardcore technical aspects of U-boat construction and layout, and who provided sound scientific counterpoint to whatever theories Chatterton entertained. Through it all, a thrilling idea had begun taking shape in Chatterton's thinking. In the course of 2 weeks, he had contact with a U-boat ace, a blimp pilot, a historian, and the president of a U-boat club. Each gave accounts of history unavailable in books, and sometimes at odds with books. To Chatterton, who had hungered since childhood for better explanations, for the chance to see for himself, this stretching of history's canvas was a revelation. While Chatterton continued to field phone calls, Kohler studied U-boats like an undergraduate before a final exam. He dedicated every free moment to understanding the U-boat, its construction, its evolution, its command chain, its lore. Much of his study was driven by an overriding motivation, to position himself to haul tonnage from the wreck. In his diving lifetime, he could not recall a moment like the one he'd experienced when he'd first laid eyes on Chatterton's Nazi China. As he'd held that dish in his hands, he'd understood that he had possession of something transcendent. He hadn't been able to enunciate it to himself at the moment, but he'd known what he was feeling. In a single piece of china, every quality that made a shipwreck artifact great—history, symbolism, beauty, mystery—seemed to come together to a brilliant point. As the days passed, and Kohler delved deeper into his U-boat studies, he found himself paying closest attention to those books about the lives and times of the U-boat man. And this surprised him, because his mission was so forcefully committed to identification and artifact recovery. Reading about men did not seem like book work to Kohler. Instead, he found himself transported. He could feel the inside of a U-boat not just as a machine, but as the backdrop to a human being's life. He could feel the grueling and claustrophobic conditions under which these soldiers waged war, the coldness of a live torpedo next to a man's sleeping face, the smell of 6-week-old underwear, the spittle in the expletives of men crammed too close to one another for too long, the splatter of a single icy condensation droplet on the neck of an enlisted man finishing a 6-hour shift. Technical information interested him, yes, but technology did not make his heart pound. Nothing did, like the idea of a U-boat man waiting helplessly while Allied depth charges tumbled through the water toward his submarine. The ominously dainty ping, ping, ping of Allied sonar, a prelude to imminent explosion. For years, Kohler had believed the U-boats to be nearly invincible. Now he began to learn of Saure Gurkenzeit, or Sour Pickle Time, the year when Allied ingenuity and technological and material superiority reversed the course of the U-boat war so decisively that U-boats sometimes went weeks without sinking a single enemy ship, when the hunters became the hunted. One source said that no fighting force in the history of warfare had taken the casualties the U-boat men had and still kept fighting. As October wore on, Kohler found himself wondering if any crewmen were still aboard the mystery U-boat, and he wondered also if their families knew that they were there. As Chatterton continued to feel the rush of phone calls and letters, he got word of a black plan. Belinda had secured the exact location of the U-boat wreck site. He was planning to hit the wreck any day. Worst of all, the numbers were said to have come from Nagel. The plan, as Chatterton heard it, was this. Belinda had organized a dedicated mission to the wreck site to recover Feldman's body. Another captain had offered his boat and fuel for the trip. Belinda was to supply the divers, who would search the area for the corpse. Chatterton doubted that Belinda or the others would make even a perfunctory search for the body. It had been a month since the accident, the tides had been strong, and Feldman had never been inside the wreck in the first place. He called Nagel at home. He heard ice clinking in a glass.
"Ah, shit, John. I gave up the numbers," Nagel admitted.
The way Nagel explained it, he had received a late-night phone call from another dive boat captain and longtime friend. Nagel had been drinking. The captain had announced that he had three sets of numbers and knew one of them to be the U-boat's location. Nagel listened as the captain recited the numbers. The captain was right. One of the sets was correct. Nagel suspected, even in his drunken haze, that Belinda had wrung the general location from his Coast Guard cronies, then had asked this captain to check his voluminous book of numbers for anything close. Now the captain, who was supposed to be Nagel's friend, was leaning on him to reveal the exact location. Ordinarily, Nagel would have chewed off the captain's head for the attempt. But, in his stupor, still guilty over Feldman's death and the Seeker's inability to bring the diver home, Nagel mumbled something about location number two possibly being correct.
"I knew I was fucked as soon as I hung up," he told Chatterton.
Shortly after Chatterton spoke to Nagel, his own phone rang. Belinda was calling. He told Chatterton that he had organized a mission to recover Feldman's body. He invited Chatterton to come along. Chatterton's face flushed. For a moment, he entertained the idea of accepting the invitation, certain that Belinda would skip the rescue aspect of the mission and allow the divers to go straight into the U-boat for artifacts. He demanded to know Belinda's true intentions. Belinda insisted that the mission was dedicated to recovering Feldman's body. Chatterton pressed, asking where the Wahoo captain intended to look for the body. Belinda told him that he would search around the wreck. This was too much for Chatterton, who believed that Belinda's only intention was to dive the U-boat. He called Belinda back and told him what he thought of the plan. Belinda protested, but Chatterton would hear none of it. Spewing out a stew of expletives, Chatterton told Belinda he wanted nothing to do with the so-called recovery mission and hung up. A few days later, Belinda and several divers made the trip. Some of the divers did, in fact, make a good-faith search for Feldman. Others just dove the wreck. No one saw a corpse. According to one of the divers on the trip, many went home that night with an overriding impression. This wreck is lunatic dangerous. This wreck is going to eat people. Word of the recovery mission reached Chatterton and Kohler a day later. They had a single question for their sources. Did anyone on the trip identify the U-boat? The answer was that no one had come close. Neither Chatterton nor Kohler was surprised. But each of them suspected that Belinda would be coming back. So long as Nagel and the Seeker remained in the spotlight, they believed, the pirate flag of Belinda's intention would fly at full mast. On a Monday in early November, just after the recovery mission, the skies bathed New Jersey in sunlight. The sight rejuvenated Nagel, and he called Chatterton.
"We can make it to the U-boat one more time," Nagel said. "We can go Wednesday. We can identify this thing Wednesday. Are you in or out?"
"Have I ever been out?" Chatterton asked.
Nagel and Chatterton made phone calls. The trip was planned for November 6, 1991. Since Feldman's death, some of the divers from the Discovery trip had decided not to tempt the U-boat again. Everyone else was in. Two empty bunks remained for Wednesday. Nagel called some legends. Tom Packer and Steve Gatto were perhaps the most formidable deep-wreck diving team on the eastern seaboard. In a sport in which the buddy system was often shunned for its potential dangers, Packer and Gatto seemed to exist as a single organism, intuiting the other's moves and needs in ways usually reserved for identical twins. Many in the wreck diving community referred to the team as Paco Gacko, for the unity with which they negotiated their dives. Packer had been part of Nagel's team when that crew took the bell off the Doria. Gatto had recovered the Doria's helm a few years later. They rarely gave up on a wreck without getting what they had come for. They told Nagel they were coming to identify the U-boat.